Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it's a beautiful Monday. I believe it's May 17th. I'm calling here from the thriving metropolis of Waco, Texas, where I'm helping my son move out of his house here from Baylor University to next year's house. So sorry if things were a little discombobulated. I was hoping to be back in Austin by now. We just finished up the EMS yesterday, so it's kind of thrown things off a little bit. Found out the crisis was going on as soon as we finished the EMS weekend. And if any of you are listening to the call from EMS weekend, we certainly, Stephanie and I and Raj and John and Janine, we just want you to know what an incredible blessing it was to be with you this past weekend. So let's just go on to the questions here. Compulsive behavior versus sexual addiction. Rick, last week my husband asked you the question how he felt before and during and after acting out. He said he never enjoyed it, didn't feel lust, sexual arousal, but anxiety and guilt with constant thoughts of me and how disgusting his acting out felt to him. He never wanted to do it, but couldn't stop. You thought a situation might be compulsive behavior. Can you explain more about it and how that differs from true sexual addiction? Is this still an addiction that needs 12-step? Would seeing a medical doctor for some medication help along with therapy? I take Lexapro because I can relate to compulsive behaviors and anxiety and depression. All three of these my husband has, two along with anger, suppressed childhood abuse, emotional abandonment, smoke, drank, same amounts of espresso, compulsively ate too. And all of these compulsive habits also, how does he find if he should focus on recovery from compulsive behaviors or sexual addiction? Well, at one level, excuse me just a second.
Thanks, Mark.
Sorry about that. So, if it were me, honestly, I would probably look a little bit at both of those issues. Hang on just a second here. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on to my wife out of the car and she can't get back in the car. Sorry about that. Okay. There is a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, OCD, which I really like. And I also like Brain Lock. But I don't know that I would try to delineate yet as to which one to focus on. Potentially medication could help. But first, before you begin to focus on the obsessive compulsive disorder, you would first need to really get somebody who knows how to appropriately diagnose that. If you're going to be working with Mark Laser, I think that's something Mark could certainly do. I think you had said once upon a time y'all would be going there. So I let Mark kind of work with that. Certainly it could still be sexual addiction, and it could even have an element of the OCD. I just don't know, not enough information. But like I said, a professional should be able to diagnose that. And if you did a psychiatric evaluation, the psychiatrist could at least give some ideas of what might help medication-wise. Let's try one more time. My husband has compulsive behavior that led to sexual addiction. Again, can you please explain why he would do something that he didn't like when he knew it would cost him what he loved? Well, I mean, that's the whole nature of obsessive compulsive disorder. You end up doing things you don't like, and that's actually one of the defining or one of the distinguishments between addiction and sexual addiction, or addiction and OCD, is that OCD is about being compelled to do something you don't want to do. Sexual addiction is more about doing something that you really feel compelled to do, more out of the high that comes from it. What goes on in their head? Well, all that goes on in someone's head with OCD is it's an intrusive thought that comes in. It's almost like a demand to do something that you don't want to do. I like something, I do it. I don't like something, I don't do it. Even if I want something bad, a milkshake, I do enjoy it. What are compulsive essays looking for with sex? He said he didn't. He did it out of habit, not sexual pleasure. Good grief. Cheating out of habit is insane. Well, again, all I'm going to say is with an addiction, the problem is, with OCD, the problem is the compulsion to wash someone's hand, for instance, when you know you don't really want to wash your hand, the compulsion not to step on a crack, the compulsion to go back and check because you think you might have just run over something, the compulsion to see if you locked the door. These are all behaviors. I mean, it's because something's wrong in someone's brain. That's where a compulsion comes from. So they certainly don't want to do it. If it is OCD, it's not pleasurable to them. Even if addiction eventually becomes unpleasurable, but the compulsion, like I mentioned to you earlier, it's like if someone has a rash, the person that doesn't have a rash, they don't have any temptation not to scratch their skin. They can scratch their skin if they wanted to. It might feel good to scratch their skin. They might even want to scratch their skin, but there's certainly no compulsion to scratch their skin. But if someone has an itch, the compulsion is there. So that's the difference. Gratitude. I've been to various retreats, groups, red forums, etc., but betrayed and unfaithful. After catching my husband this January and then finally admitting to the affair 3 months later, confirmed a polygraph test, he had the epiphany with ARC's help about what drove him was a very old pattern of using sex as a compulsive behavior, sexual addiction. He was only upset for a moment, then came relief when he was full, and he was full of energy, commitment, repentant, remorseful beyond words, patient with me, relying on God and his ARC mentor with a new heart. Why do so many husbands blame their wives for what happened, or pull away from them, or tell their wives not to express their painful feelings, or act apathetic? I don't understand if they want the marriage to heal, why do they do this? I understand if they have a limerent affair, it's different. But if it's a sexual addiction or a one-night stand, there are no emotional attachments. It feels for the wives. So I feel for the wives. And as soon as my husband finally disclosed, confirmed the polygraph that all the truth was really out, he was a changed man. He said all of his energy that went into keeping the secrets was now free to be used in a healthy way. Am I being naive, believing my husband is sincere? Maybe he's just faking because he knows I'd end the marriage if he wasn't 100% honest and committed to healing. He was a really good liar for 4 years. Am I being stupid for believing his love, passion, commitment now? Is he just scared to lose me and his baby? I have not agreed to stay married. I only agreed to wait a year before making any decision. I love him, but I'm very hurt. He had sex with another woman and lied to me for so long. Now, in answer to that particular question, the reason that people lie are typically, and even this weekend at the EMS weekend, the reason they actually blame their mate is, it's an unconscious defense mechanism. It's a rationalization. I think a lot of times it's the way that we push away guilt. If I can blame, if it can be somebody else's fault, then I don't have to feel bad about myself. And so for the addict, what begins to happen is, you know, when they get caught, the first thing they want to do is rationalize what they've done. And so they'll frequently point the finger at somebody else. But even if they don't do that, the next problem that begins to occur is for the sex addict is if their mate asks why, at the initial point of recovery, typically the unfaithful spouse really doesn't have an understanding as to why they're doing what they're doing. So when their mate says, why do you do it, and they try to explain, that typically leads them to what I would call almost a blaming behavior. Just the simple fact, the only why that they understand at that point is going to be the why of, you know, they'll blame the marriage naturally. And so that's why I typically tell people, if your mate on the front end asks why, just say, I have no idea yet. I'm doing everything I can, ultimately, to try to figure out, you know, what the why might be. But I think it would be, you know, dangerous, at the least, for me to try to say the why I did it at this point without really having time and kind of understanding what all that might, what all might be behind the why. But it's usually if they begin to explain that why, then early on, they're going to look at the marriage, and because they think in terms of cause and effect, and the only way they can do cause and effect is kind of they look at what's immediate. It's difficult. They don't even have the skill set necessary to begin to look at potentially what might be underneath that. Polygraph. I just read a post from a woman married to a sex addict who sounds just like my husband. He took a polygraph test and beat it. She said months later he confessed a bunch more about his affairs, acting out, and all this while he was going through recovery and pretending everything was out. I had my husband take a polygraph to confirm everything was out. I can't do this. Now I have nothing to find peace. He has parts of his story that do not make sense, but now I'm relying on my intuition, which tell me he's still lying to manage his image. What do you suggest? I'm going to lose my sanity. I'll never feel safe. I'll never know the whole truth. Okay, so in my career, I've had 3 or 4 people beat the polygraph. Now, that being said, and I don't know anything about this situation and who posted that, but a lot of polygraphers, and so you just heard the number, 3 or 4, so it's not that it can't happen. But what you're telling me about your husband in the past in terms of his own anxiety would tell me he's not the person who can beat a polygraph. And it also depends a lot on the polygrapher and the type of polygraph test that he's given. There's a pretty good book about the use of a polygraph and how to use a polygraph. I think it's Hope and Recovery by Magnus. You might want to look at that book. But typically the polygraph is very accurate. And you bet. You know, there are always, have always been, a very few people who can do that. The difference between those people and the normal population is they generally don't care whether or not they lose the marriage because of the way the polygraph works. So if you have somebody who really doesn't care, period, then, you know, conceivably it can be done. But if you've got a good polygrapher, even then it's almost impossible. So I wouldn't lose faith in the polygraph. I use them all the time. I think they're highly accurate. No way out. He appears doing everything to show his remorse and disgust. He's in full recovery and excited to get better, but I feel worse. I can't find a way to wrap my head around him planning behind my back, sleeping the same way in the bed with me and having sex, dishonoring me and putting his lust for her first. I can't express with words. Why should anything he does matter at all? Well, whether or not anything he does, it matters. Whether you choose to let it matter for you would kind of be a little bit of your source, and I think that's a lot of the pain that a lot of people go through. You know, I love, you know, some of Leslie's work when she talks about that it takes literally, you know, the husband in the situation or the wife who had the unfaithful mate will actually tend to get better a lot faster. While for the hurt spouse, there's a continued sense of, you know, just pain. And so the hurt spouse tends to get better much slower than the unfaithful spouse. So, you know, I would hope that over time you're going to be able to, you know, if you can see his heart, then I hope over time you can sit there and say, it does matter to me. Because either he
cares for you or he doesn't. But if it feels like he cares for you and is remorseful and owns what he did and is willing to do what he needs to do to get better, there is a really good reason to let it matter to you, because in the long run, you may be far better off than you would be if you left the relationship. I may have quoted this on here before, but, you know, research shows that if you work things out with Pierre, 5 years from now, there's a really good chance you're going to be supremely happy in relationship. This is some work that someone that Stephen Covey was working with. If you go ahead and get divorced, there's only a 17% chance you'll be really happy in 5 years. So, you know, I don't know that divorce is the answer. Why should it matter? Because maybe someone sees they did something wrong and wants to change. Whether or not you want to be involved with someone who's capable of doing this, that's a whole other question, and I think that's a difficult one to ask. You know, if a person's heart, if they're trying to go the right direction, to me it feels that it may be worth it in the long run. But I know that's very individual kind of question that people have to go through. Hello, Rick. My wife had a year-long affair with a very good friend of mine. 4 hours. She says it only happened 4 times throughout the year. Just really drunk and stupid choices on her behalf and him sliding in on our marriage. That wasn't going well. And they started talking about it. She says that she would regret it and feel ashamed and guilty every time, but then every 4 months or so do it again. I just don't understand that logic. How do you feel all those ways and say that she still loves me, but go ahead and do it again? How does that happen? Knowing and feeling that it was wrong, but still not stop it. She says she has no emotional attachment to him at all and never wanted to leave me for him. It just happened. I don't get that either. How does that happen? They wouldn't meet up or plan anything. I think she says just some nights decided to do it, twice with me in the same house and twice while I was at home with the kids and she was out with friends, because I trusted her. Is it really possible that it can happen like this with him and like this, and she feel all those ways that she did, knowing that it could, what it would cause? She didn't stop all contact with him, and that was before I was, I even knew what I was going to reconcile or leave her. They spoke on the phone a couple of times, and she told him she didn't want to speak to him or ever see him again. How does this even happen then if she loved me so much and hated it first and hated herself for doing it? She says she tried to block it out every time and stopped other times that he wanted to. I just don't know what to believe. Why do it sometimes and not all the time if you were already doing it? I just don't know. I'm just confused, I guess. Thank you for your time. Okay. So I don't know. Obviously, I mean, I think every situation is so individualistic. When you were talking, I was, to get down to why someone responds like that and what causes that, typically it's arrogance. At the bottom line, at the deepest level, it's an arrogance and it's a pride. It's somebody thinking they can handle a situation, putting themselves in a situation, and then not being strong enough to handle the desires that kind of come from putting themselves back in that high-risk situation. And in that moment, it kind of seems like, you know, it's almost like a deception. I mean, that's the way I think our false self or our old nature kind of works. But what happens is, you know, that temptation's there, and we think we should be able to do this. We should be able to put ourselves in this situation, and it won't happen. We won't do it. But typically what, you know, some people find out, just depending on kind of their own weakness in the flesh and why that is for them, that's a whole other matter. But when they're in that situation, they're powerless over it. It ultimately, you know, consumes them. And it may not be 100% of the time that they give in and do it. It may only be 20% of the time. It may only be, you know, 7 times out of 100, or it may only be 5 times out of 100. But regardless, you know, there's still times that the intensity of the urge that's created by that interaction is stronger than their willpower. And it sounds like that's certainly true of your wife. So, you know, and why she does that. I was thinking of another woman I'm working with right now. And she had what, she's what I call abuse reactive. And she was a teenager. She actually had sex with an older guy, didn't feel like she had the right to say no. But then once she got into her, and never really wanted to be, I think, with any of the other people, but she still ended up acting out sexually with someone or different people 4 or 5 times in a marriage, even though it's not what she wanted. It's almost like she couldn't say no once she got into the situation, but she still had too much pride to admit that she couldn't be in the situation, so she foolishly continued to put herself in the situation, which she ultimately couldn't control. And then she would always feel incredibly guilty and bad and horrible afterwards, but then, and resolve never to do it again, and feel really confident that she'd never do it again, because when she resolved not to do it again, she was 100% serious. The only problem was, it really wasn't her call as to whether she did it again. I mean, once she put herself back in that situation, even if it was only 3 times out of 10 or 3 times out of 50, you know, there were going to be those times because of kind of her own broken nature, because of what happened to her during adolescence, that she was going to do that. The second thing is, not everybody has the same kind of hole in their soul. I mean, what, you know, kind of the lie that she hears in her head, the thing that tells her that ultimately what will make her happy won't be the same thing that maybe you have or her friends have. Everybody has kind of their own unique twist in terms of that itch that they get when there's a part of them that thinks there's something that would make them feel better. If someone is acting out with someone that's close to them, typically that's an indication, what they already know, that they're not loose in a sense. I mean, it's almost like it has to be somewhat relational in nature. It's probably about, I mean, who knows? I don't want to speculate too much about what that would be about for her. I think she would have to do a lot of digging to understand why she's done that. But it does make complete sense to me. You know, at least to me it does, how, you know, because of that kind of hole in her soul, whenever she's, you know, in those situations, whatever that is, at some point it becomes stronger than something she can control, and therefore she gives in. So hopefully that that will help. You know, the fact, too, that, you know, it'd go off and on, you know, this. For some people, one last comment on that, there's almost like a strange intrigue. You don't really want to do it, but again, the kind of the that broken part of us keeps, you know, keeps lying to you, saying, you know, you don't want to do it. But there's another part of you that says you ought to still be able to handle it, but you're still curious, but you don't. It's just weird. And then again, once they get into that situation, they fall. So, you know, I'm sorry you're going through all of that, and hopefully that answer will help a little bit. But if you really want to kind of get deeper to it, I think you're going to have to, she's got to do a little bit of work, and hopefully someone can help her understand. And from your perspective, just remember, even though that, you know, it's not, that sort of thing may not be a temptation to you, it certainly was to her. But I would also say, from your perspective, whether or not she's safe, you know, is she willing to admit she's got an issue with this? Because, I mean, if someone's done that for a year, I would say, there's a problem.
And I can guarantee you she felt bad about it every time she said she wasn't going to do it again. So her just saying she's not going to do it again and not doing something to me would be a little frightening. I'd want her to begin to address what it is that made her go there in the first place. Okay, cycle of failure. We watched the DVD on the cycle of failure, and I'm having a hard time applying it to my husband's affair. Can you give a real-life example of how the cycle plays out? He said after he had sex with her in June of 2009 while I was pregnant, he went out and bought baby clothes to make up for it. But is this pretend normal? So when he would all of a sudden be loving and present with me, was this pretend normal? Usually he was dark, moody, and preoccupied. Then all of a sudden, he'd go back to who he was when we met and were happy and affectionate and sweet. But it was out of the blue. He drove me crazy. I didn't know why he would switch on and off. When you say squeezed, I asked Pierre if he can say what made him feel squeezed and act out. He said he just always in general felt shameful, unworthy, unlovable, incapable of being happy. Is this constant with the squeeze? Well, actually, those things would be more the aftermath of the squeeze. And sometimes the squeeze is internal, where it's just our own problem that causes us to feel that way. When you say false remorse, does that mean he got to the point to where he didn't feel so bad about what he did? No, actually, false remorse is far more about fear. It's more about the fear of what you would do if you were to discover. So he doesn't want to lose you. False remorse is kind of, I'm sorry, in an effort to smooth things over, to kind of calm my anxiety. So it's not really what I would call true remorse, which is far more about grief over what I've done to another person. False remorse is more about, you know, my fear of losing someone and then what I'll do to keep losing the marriage. Why would he ever want to tell himself it was not bad? Well, the reason nobody would want to say it's bad is they feel guilty, so they minimize it just to push away the intense emotions being created by the circumstance. Pretend normal at one level to me, was that pretend normal when he was being nice to you? I don't know. He may have had some genuine feelings, but if he was still lying about the affair and deceiving you, he certainly was pretending to be one thing when he was really being something else. Not letting you in, not being in recovery, all of those things would definitely be pretend normal. So hopefully that helps a little bit with that one. Is it normal to feel detached when the course first starts? I would assume that would be 911 or Harboring Hope, and yes, absolutely. Many of the women say they're crying a lot, but I'm calm, hurt, and I have no reaction to the 911 DVD homework or call. It's usually anger because I can just see my husband's affair explained with psychology, and that makes me more mad for some reason. You were just like that. Now I understand why you were totally absent with me. I'm afraid I'm not progressing. At least maybe the program is letting me get my feelings out, even if I don't cry. My D-Day was April 2010. The fact is, for most people, they don't know whether they're going forward or backward for a very long time. What I recommend is that people pick a point of time somewhere way out in the future, like 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, and really write down carefully where they are today, and then on that day on the calendar, write down where they are before they read where they were back then, write down where they feel like they are today, and then, you know, and what's good about the relationship, what's not good about the relationship, and then read the two. So I think usually what people find
they're either going to be trending better or they're going to be trending worse. If they're trending worse, something's not working, and it may not even work out. But you need to be able to identify, why are we going backwards and not going forward? But I would give yourself some time. 2 months, 3 months is not very much time. I mean, that's still in kind of the shock stage. I think you'll have a much better grasp probably at 6 months and 12 months, you know, if you choose to stay in it. But like I said, I wouldn't try to judge each day or judge where you're at by what happens on a daily basis. Because right now there's so much emotion, it's very difficult. And you may be numb, but the emotion's still there. It's just that different people have different ways of kind of handling that emotion. Let's see. This last week has been painful for a lot of people on the forum, going by many posts. Is there a healthy way to respond to be with others and understanding your pain without being overwhelmed by it, sharing without being toxic? You know, I think that you can validate a person's pain. To me, I don't know if you remember the kind of that exercise about the truth triangle, but a lot of times for me, if I'm kind of being overwhelmed, I'll sit there and say, you know, I feel, you know, X, but I know the truth. So one thing to do is, in a cognitive sense, be sure to begin to start what you're saying with your feelings, not what's ultimately true. You know, it is possible for people on the forum, once, you know, it kind of gets really emotional and there are a lot of people hurting and there's a lot of fear, it's like that tends to, for people who haven't grown enough, haven't matured enough, where their feelings haven't reset enough, all conversations become emotional conversations and people lose the ability to have rational conversations. Backing up and kind of trying to maintain some detachment from our feelings and trying to be rational, but at some level, at least trying to focus on what's true, is going to be a really useful thing. But always, you know, when you're even in your head, say, this is what I'm feeling, but then always counter that with what you think is really the truth. Because remember, feelings aren't bad. They just are. But they don't necessarily reflect wisdom, and they don't necessarily reflect truth. I mean, sometimes a cognitive distortion can create incredible feelings, even though nothing happens. And it's just the way, the attitude kind of that we are, the way we've looked at the circumstance. So I think it's really important to, again, whenever you're having a feeling, and you can encourage people to do this, you know, put down what you fear, and then also then put down what, not what you feel, but, you know, ultimately what you think, you know, truth might be, other than an alternative ultimately to what you feel. After doing our history timeline, I realized that my husband was only happy during our relationship when we were not together. We spent a lot of time apart because he traveled and had to spend a relationship. We spent a lot of time apart because he traveled and we had to spend months in Italy waiting for his visa. When he actually was with me, in reality, he wouldn't stay happy for long and could go long periods of time without acting out. And could not go long periods of time without acting out. Is this part of a fantasy? Not being able to live in reality with real relationships. When he was away from me, he fantasizes about us. When he was with me for an extended period of time, he fantasized and then acted out as a fair partner and had cyber sex back and forth. He realizes also at Mark Laser's workshop this weekend that he used fantasy forever and that he had imaginary friends as a kid. His parents emotionally abandoned and physically abused him. And then pornography was a huge fantasy and start of his essay. What's the purpose? Escape? Wanting? Is this really an inability to have a real relationship and deal in reality?
Yeah, to some extent, you know, there's such an intimacy impairment, I think, that comes with sexual addiction. And so you've almost got, or the people dealing with that, sometimes when they're close to what is real, it's almost like that makes them anxious because of the kind of underlying shame and the guilt and the fear of exposure. So, you know, they'll almost, to manage the shame and the guilt and those things, you know, the shame ends up being a catalyst that can propel them into new places. You know, it's hard. I think when couples get into recovery, the tendency is to want to compare where we are now or to understand where we are now, kind of juxtapose against where we were then. And it's just hard to even maybe comprehend where we are now. But again, if you have someone that you're married to that's addressing the issue, not telling you to get over it, not trying to, maybe trying to understand it, but not trying to blame you, I mean, that's not kind of their primary thing, then at that point, you've still got something that is potentially, you know, a good relationship. But again, you're going to have to be patient with yourself and kind of work through all of those things, because it's a very, very long process. And, you know, each week you'll find you discover more and more, I think, till you eventually come to the place to where maybe you've at least got your mind around it. Let's see, my wife and I have been separated for about 2 months. Her affair began a year ago and ended in January. She'll still be living alone in an apartment until August, and we're using your separation agreement for guidelines during this 5 months we're apart. I'm continuing to work on my own issues and working on our marriage. But she still seems to be running and hiding from her issues. Instead of using the time to reflect and grow, she's doing happy hour 3 to 4 times out a week. And when we do spend time together, she keeps her distance and makes it clear that we're just friends. And there's nothing there. I'd let her know. Last week, she met up with a guy. She's been texting, calling for a few beers in a bar near her apartment. She told me about this guy, told me about this the next day, and assured me they were just friends. Back to the word just. And there was nothing there. I let her know. This behavior was not acceptable for me and felt like I was being cheated on all over again. She told me that she was an adult and she could make her own choices. She doesn't seem to understand that my trust is something that she needs to earn back, and she doesn't seem interested in earning it back at this point. It seems impossible to work out this issue when she's still fumbling around like a teenager with no direction or commitment to our relationship. I'm not sure how much longer I want to wait for the strong, beautiful woman I once knew. This roller coaster has gone on for almost a year now, and while there's still times that we truly connect, she's still ambivalent about our marriage. I still have lots of hope, and I know God can completely restore our marriage and more, but at what point do I say enough is enough and move on without her? Okay, great question. You know, there are a couple of things. One of the things, earned trust is one thing. The problem with earning trust, it's almost like if I have to earn trust, if this makes sense, it's almost like I've got to jump through somehow to make that happen. If, when somebody's in recovery, they're really not about earning trust. They're really about trying to be trustworthy out of concern and compassion for another person. That's a very different heart attitude. If someone's trying to be trustworthy to help their mate out versus where someone's trying to earn trust. And so the second problem I've got is if, you know, she's still in kind of this, you know, I have my rights, and she's still ambivalent about the relationship. I believe the best course of action when you've got somebody who doesn't quite know what they want yet is, in your mind, set a date, set a time, and then at the end of that time period, if she doesn't move forward, then I think you just sit there and you say, okay, you pull the trigger. I don't think you let her know what that time period is. But I don't think it's going to be in our best interest because, again, my main premise is love will always act in the best interest of another person. And I don't think it's in her best interest to allow her to continue being ambivalent for forever in a relationship because ultimately it ends up enabling her. So, you know, if you had said, okay, we're going to do this for 3 months, we're going to do this for 30 days, whatever, I mean, again, not telling her that, but at the end of 30 days, what I would say to someone is, look, you know, I love you. I would love to be in a relationship with you. I want to be with you. And I think you know that. But, you know, the bottom line is it's not okay, you know, to treat someone the way you're treating me if you're in a committed relationship, you know, and there's something really wrong. So, you know, you need to go get help. But, you know, I'm moving on. And, because there's no sense, you know, I have enough self-respect here. There's no sense that I need to wait for you to decide whether or not you want to be in a committed relationship. If you want to go have your fun, go have your fun. But I want to find somebody who wants to be serious about life. And just tell them, and let them go out of love. Say, you know, I'm not doing you any favors here. All I'm doing is allowing you to kind of go down a path that I think ultimately is going to be destructive for you and destructive for our family. So, God bless you, and I'll see you later. So I do think with that type of individual, you only go for so long before you, you know, just say, it's time to move on. And, you know, I would, for a lot of times I'll recommend that people do that for 90 days, whatever. Now, I wouldn't know in your situation. It sounds like you've been doing this for a while. But again, I wouldn't try to get her permission. I wouldn't try to use leaving her as a tool of manipulation. I would just sit there and decide, you know, how much time, you know, God wants you to give her. And then if that doesn't happen, then go ahead and tell her that you love her dearly, but, you know, it's not okay to be that way. And that love always acts in the best interest of another person. You're not acting in her best interest by allowing this. And then go on from there. So hopefully that answers your question. And I think that's the end of our questions for the day. I want to thank everybody for posting. And you guys have a great week. And for the 911 people, I'll talk with y'all tomorrow. Otherwise, I'll catch everybody next Monday. Thank you.